Ms. Shalupka, good morning to you. Let's give everybody a moment to get in and out of the courtroom. And I will start by apologizing to both parties for probably butchering the names of the parties involved here. But with that, you may proceed.
I have no problem waiting. I'm not here. In seriousness, Chief Justice Hevigan, may it please the court, my name is Marin Lynn Shalupka. I am here out of Scott's Bluff, and I represent Mrs. Sulu. And we're asking this court respectfully to reverse the decision of Judge Joel Bravone granting summary judgment to the defense for two reasons. First, the district court made an incorrect and important, unfortunately, finding of fact that the complaints that Kim Magana solicited against Mrs. Sulu were truthful. Simply wrong, and it's refuted by the record. The second reason is that the district court was mistaken when he ruled that in the calculus of whether a defendant's interference is justified or unjustified, the ends can justify inappropriate means. This is a case about a parent's desire to customize her own child's education without regard to the consequences outside of her own household. Mrs. Magana wanted more grammar and less culture education for her son in his Spanish classes. So she secretly persuaded another teenager outside of her family to put Mrs. Magana's complaints into a letter under the other teenager's byline.
She persuaded counsel, before you get deeply into the merits of this, could you take just a moment or two to address how this was appealed the first time, whether the first order was conditional or not conditional, and what effect that all has on the second appeal?
I wanted the courtroom before I had to talk about it. Yes, Your Honor, I jumped the gun badly on filing this appeal. The order came out sustaining the defense's motion for summary judgment, and I was anxious about wanting to get the appeal underway, and I filed a notice of appeal right away. And I've been here enough, I have no idea why I did that. Mr. Guthrie filed a motion for costs, which I darn well should have known he was going to do, which he had the right to do. And at that point came the exercise in trying to straighten out the mess that I had caused. A valid final order is the only thing that can be appealed from. In that J&W Swine case that I was referred to by a very patient court asking what on earth I was doing, in that case, we had a litigant who appealed improvidently before the final judgment was entered and then didn't file a new appeal when the final judgment actually did get entered. In this case, with the cooperation and courtesy of Mr. Guthrie, we got jurisdiction restored to the district court. We then, at that point, had a hearing on costs. The judge entered a final order on costs, and at that point, I re-appealed it. That was the first point at which we had a valid final order. That's what we're going for.
So are you relying on the language in the June 27, 2014 district court order that said motions for costs which are pending or which may be filed will be set for hearing on a proper motion?
I can give a little more context on that. There was a non-party in this case, the school district, who had, within the course of discovery, moved for costs for cooperating with the subpoena. And that was not ruled on at the time and eventually was taken up post-summary judgment at that point. Mr. Guthrie's motion for costs wasn't on file at that point. It was a non-party's motion for costs.
Is that in our record, either in the first appeal or the second appeal?
I think it is because I think that was part of supplemental transcript from the defense on this point.
Okay.
If it isn't, I'll file a motion for supplemental transcript. Sorry. But I think it is in our transcript.
Okay, thank you.
Are you making that motion now?
Well, I could do that. So I think I will. Let's see if anybody wants to sustain it.
Mr. Guthrie wishes to comment.
Well, let's let Mr. Guthrie... Let's assume you've now made the motion, and Mr. Guthrie can have some time to respond to it, and we will act on the motion after oral arguments.
Thank you, Judge.
Yes.
I'm going to get to the factual findings that were made by the district court. The district court had made a couple of findings relative to its statement that her mission was to bring about changes to the Spanish curriculum. That was the district court's ruling. Thus, her actions, according to the district court, are justified. Now, that conclusion came from the district court's factual finding. Quote, there is no evidence that the assertions in the letter are untruthful, referring to the letter of complaint. And then a second factual finding that, quote, there is no evidence that Mrs. Magana knew the contents of the letter before it was sent or told the student what to put in the letter. Both of these factual findings are important because it goes to the question of whether her actions were unjustified, and both of these factual findings are wrong and are refuted by the record. I'll take them one at a time, starting with the claim that there is no evidence that the assertions of the letter are untruthful. The letter is at Exhibit 74 in your Bill of Exceptions, and it's a litany of complaints against Mrs. Sulu. And those complaints were investigated by the school principal when the letter was unrevealed. The principal is Mr. Mike Hawley, and his deposition appears at Exhibit 27 in the Bill of Exceptions. And at about page 47 of his deposition, that is when he testified about what he learned in his investigation. What he found out was that the bulk of the claims in the letter, and certainly the major claims in the letter, were untruthful, were not true. For example, the letter claimed, made a specific claim, and a rather audacious claim, that the teacher's curriculum is based off of movies, songs, and games. Now, if that were true, if a upper-level world language class had based the curriculum off of movies, songs, and games, that would show that we've got a pretty frivolous curriculum. It certainly would warrant review. But when Mr. Hawley investigated that, he found that most of the students said they'd watched only one movie. There were no games played. The letter claimed that Mrs. Sulu was dismissive of students who voiced concerns about the curriculum, about these non-existent movies and songs and games. What Mr. Hawley found out, as he said in his deposition, is that few, if any, students had ever felt so irate as to complain, and that when that had happened, on the rare occasion that a student did voice a complaint, Mrs. Sulu dealt with it appropriately. He found that two students wanted their names taken off of the letter. He found that some of the students who signed the letter expressed personal animus for Spanish class, and that other kids signed it simply because everybody else was doing it. He warned the superintendent that the author of the letter has a personal dislike for Mrs. Sulu. And so the complaints in this letter and the teenager who says that she wrote it were discredited. They were found to be false.
I'm sorry, who's author? To whom is author referring in that comment?
That would be getting into the second factual finding, Justice Nora Lehrman, that I would take issue with from the district court, which is that he says there's no evidence that Mrs. Magana knew the contents of the letter before it was sent or told the student what to put in the letter. Now, it's true. When I deposed Mrs. Magana, when I deposed the teenager, when I deposed the other teacher who was in cahoots with her, Mr. Keener, and I asked them what was said in your meeting together about this letter, they all developed they were all immediately afflicted with litigation amnesia and couldn't answer. But we have circumstantial evidence to speak to that. Exhibit 54 in the Bill of Exceptions, Exhibit 54 is a screenshot of an online conversation on Facebook in which another teacher asks this teenager, who put you up to writing this letter, Mr. Keener or Mrs. Magana? The teenager doesn't say, what are you talking about? She writes back and says, both. So there's some circumstantial evidence, number one. Circumstantial evidence, number two. Both Mrs. Sulu and another teacher deposed, Cassie Benitez, heard Luke Keener say that Mrs. Magana helped write the letter. And then the most important circumstantial evidence that I'll get out quickly is that the complaints in this letter perfectly matched what Mrs. Magana voiced to Mr. Keener when she approached him about wanting more rigor and less culture in Spanish classes. Exhibit 105 in the Bill of Exceptions is Luke Keener's very unusual secret diary of his obsessions about Mrs. Sulu. This case has got a real cast of characters, and Mr. Keener wrote that at a back-to-school picnic, Mrs. Magana told him that she's frustrated with the Spanish situation and she wants to have a heated discussion And she told me, Mr. Keener, not to back down when it comes to the need to teach more vocabulary and grammar and less culture. You look at one exhibit 111, Mr. Keener says to her in an email, I've got just the student you need to meet. And from that meeting, here comes the letter, and it's talking about culture. The complaints match up against what Mrs. Magana had complained to Mr. Keener about. Circumstantial evidence is evidence. Our jury instructions say so. And so for the district court to say there was no evidence on this point and that therefore the complaints must have been justified is simply not right.
Or the inference. This is summary judgment. The inferences from all of this.
Inferences from all of this ought to go, of course, to the person I represent, because I'm here as the appellant. It ought to go toward Mrs. Sulu, the non-movement. And the inferences from that circumstantial evidence certainly show that we have a parent here who wants to customize this education, who ginned up a teenager to tell lies on her behalf. Statements were not truthful. Statements were not just, and the interference was not justified. Thank you, Your Honors.
Thank you. Mr. Guthrie, good morning.
Good morning, Your Honor.
Mr. Guthrie, I would wish to apologize if I failed to seem impartial with respect to supplementing the record.
No, I didn't take it that way.
Thank you.
I wasn't quite clear on the question I was supposed to address. I'm representing Kim Magani along with my co-counsel.
Yeah, I think the issue is whether or not Ms. Shalupka can supplement the record.
And perhaps what she wanted to ask, because I think it may be in the record.
One of my clerks has advised me that motion is in the supplemental transcript of the previous appeal. And so really the question becomes, is there any objection to our taking notice of the transcript of the previous appeal?
No, I assumed it would be part of this record. I think the motion for cost, is that the one that you...
Yes.
Well, the mystery here is what is cost referring to, I think. In the order.
And I have no objection to taking the judicial notice or having it considered part of the record here for the transcript of the motion.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Thank you very much.
I think there are three reasons that this case should be affirmed and one reason that the case should be dismissed. One relates to the issue of jurisdiction. I'll go through it unless the court wants me to go directly to the jurisdictional question. I can go through the issue.
Probably ought to talk about that first.
My belief that the decision was final and the first decision was final decision. And while parties were somewhat confused or not sure about that, I went back to the cases that this Court of Appeals or this Court suggested we look at for jurisdictional issues. They specifically asked us to address that in their brief of the Swine and Salkin cases. And I find that I believe the rule is when the case that was filed, most of the cases talk about this are under 25A24, which is asking for frivolous lawsuit, asking for attorney's fees and costs. Under the other two cases or statutes that I think are relevant are 25-17-10, which is a matter of course of a defendant on being successful is entitled to costs upon a judgment being entered. Whereas on 25-8-24, it says, shall become a award of costs that may have filed by the court may become part of or must become part of the judgment. I think there's a substantial distinction here because there were no motions pending. Salkin Court decided that for recovery for costs or attorney's fees under 824, it had to be filed before the judgment was entered on the underlying case.
There were no motions pending under 824.
In this case, not only the plaintiff nor the defendant had a motion.
Well, what about this pending motion by the third party, the school district?
As I recall, there was a motion filed for costs by the school district after my motion on July 7th and July 14th. Might have been one filed before they never sure about what happened to that one.
I understood Ms. Chalupka to say that the non-party filed a motion for costs in connection with a discovery matter.
I think there was a motion. It wasn't a discovery matter, and there was one filed. It's filed about July 14th of 2014. That did relate to that. Whether there was one earlier, I'm sure that was resolved or ruled on. I recall. I think there was one. That was it was not a party. It's filed under Rule 633A. And also, they filed it under public records decision, procedure when you can ask for public records outside of litigation, but I think the court considered it under Discovery Rule 334.
So it's a miscellaneous motion?
Yes, by a non-party.
By a non-party.
Yeah, so for costs in this case, the only ones that were pending at the time that the judgment was entered was plaintiff's defendant's costs. And later was one filed after. Both of them were filed after the judgment was announced by the trial court.
So there weren't any on file with respect to 25-824?
No, there wasn't. Definitely. Now, I think the filing of the motion for costs can come after the judgment. In fact, it's way historically that I read 25-1708 and 1710, which the plaintiff and defendant was. As they say, it shall become upon judgment being entered. So that seems to be the first. And I think then you say, how do you deal with that? Is that a final order? I think it is under 1902, which talks about summary applications. After a judgment is entered, you can file for summary application, and that becomes a final order itself. So I think the original decision was a final order, and the second time around, was an order on cost was also a final, separate final order. So that means that it was too late to reappeal after the case was dismissed. The first appeal was dismissed. Any questions?
Okay. I assume you want to go on to the other.
I will.
Assume we don't dismiss it.
That is correct, in case you don't. The reason I think this should be affirmed, we need to focus differently than the plaintiff's looking at from Ms. McGonigal's standpoint in this case. The focus of what the conversation was there is no evidence that the letter was written. In fact, the evidence is contrary to that, undisputed, and that's what the district court determined. There was no dispute as to the record. The person that wrote the letter testified, and Ms. McGonigal testified. There was no one that testified the letter was written, drafted, reviewed, edited, or seen by Ms. McGonigal before it was sent to the school board or the superintendent of the school district. And it was not solicited. The solicitation of student signature was not done by Ms. McGonigal. The evidence is the first time she saw the letter was when she got it as a school board member along with the other school board members. So the focus of what was said, what is the truthful part, doesn't focus on the content of the letter. It focuses on what Ms. McGonigal told student when she asked her, what should I do, because she was dissatisfied with the curriculum in her classroom, which she reported. And what she reported, Ms. McGonigal, the record says, and there's no dispute about this, she had said she had talked to the teacher and she had talked to the principal and wasn't satisfied, so she asked Ms. McGonigal, what can I do? The truthful part needs to be looked at from this statement. Her response was, Ms. McGonigal's response was, you could send a letter to the superintendent and copies to the school board. There's nothing untruthful about that. It's not the content of the letter that was stated by Ms. McGonigal. She didn't write it. She didn't see it. She didn't know what it said beforehand. So that's what the focus of the conversation is. It's not the content of the letter being truthful or untruthful, which is a red herring in this case, in my opinion. So that when you focus on that, then you find that making that statement is not an unjustified act in this context of Ms. McGonigal being a school board member for 12 years, being on the curriculum committee for 12 years, and then in interest in that, for her to give that conversation, if it was her opinion, it was whether it was truthful, best to her knowledge, she could do that in a student. I would think whether you're a board member or not, you can do that, tell somebody that would be a good opinion you're going to have, you can have. So that's the focus of the conversation. It wasn't unjustified, and that conduct was not unlawful, not a separate tort of its own. It was not illegal. It wasn't an unjustified act. I think that could be decided by this court, by the district court on undisputed evidence of what the conversation was as a matter of law. Second reason, I think, is the claim was, in this case, is set not as a tort claim against a school board member because the Tort Claim Act wasn't followed by the plaintiff in this case, and because of 713.910, subsection 7, prevents claims under the Political Subdivision Act for tortious interference. So it's much easier to simply say, I'm suing for not doing things. You'll see in the record they complain because she didn't follow board policy or this wasn't the right protocol for board. They want to sue her in an individual capacity. Pretty clear that it doesn't fit in the Tort Claim Act. So, but it wouldn't have been allowed anyway. And so she doesn't. We were entitled to protection of the Tort Claim Act because we were acting, the court found. Ms. McGonigal was acting in her capacity as a board member and as a parent. If she was a board member acting, that she has immunity and protection of the Tort Claim Act.
Under sub 7, an intentional act are one of the items listed.
It's a subsection 7 is one of the acts listed.
Yeah, thank you.
The third reason that we believe that the action should be, the decision should be affirmed is the comment, again, back to the comment, not writing the letter, but the content of the letter, but the advice given to her, the student, that you could send a letter to the board, the director, school board, and to the superintendent. Certainly protected speech, whether you're the board member or citizen, that was their opinion, what you could do, what you were entitled to do.
But wasn't there circumstantial evidence that someone heard Magana say that she had contributed to the language that was set forth in the letter?
I'm sorry, that you heard Magana say about, Your Honor?
I thought there was some evidence that there that Magana had stated to someone that she had helped draft the form of the letter that was sent.
Oh, okay, I remember what you said. So that was on the, when she said, Val, who helped you write the letter? She said, both.
Mm-hmm.
Later, you'll find in the record that she was asking about deposition about that. She meant, simply meant she gave her the indication of whether she, how she could write, what she could do with writing the letter. That was clarified in that. But there's no evidence. You look at the deposition of Sarah Jacobs as a student. Look at her deposition. It's pretty clear that there was no contact. Other than there was one meeting between Magana and the Sarah Jacobs student at the time, and Ms. Peter was there. After that, there was no other contact. It was several days before the letter was written. So you can see that the evidence establishes that there was no writing or circumstantial whether it's otherwise that she wrote the letter, talked about what the content, or talked about the content other than her curriculum was a little complaint that was made by the student to Ms. Ganya. So we think the freedom of speech type would have been a protection there, not as a tortious interference claim, but statement simply that you have a right to write the letter, even if she had said under free speech, even if she said you can say you can make your complaints or describe the complaints if you have those, it would be a protected speech under the situation, in our opinion, in addition to the other two reasons. Time is up. Thank you, Your Honor.
Thank you very much. Do we have time for rebuttal?
She is over.
There is no time for rebuttal. We will go on then to the next case of the day, which is actually two cases consolidated for argument, Elamine versus Frakes and Evans versus Frakes. Mr. Soucy, good morning to you.
Good morning, Mr. Chief Justice, members of the court. My name is Jerry.